Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on the former Australian Prime Minister, Stanley Melvin Bruce. Unfortunately, Dr. Anne Moyle, who was going to give one of the papers today, is sick. She's in Canberra and has a very bad cough and couldn't make the plane. So we're going to lead off with David Lee, and then I'm going to read Anne Moyle's paper, which we'll publish in the normal way, and then we'll have questions and discussion to David. So I'll introduce our two speakers briefly. David Lee is Director of Historical Publications Section at the Department of Foreign Affairs of Trade and author of Stanley Melvin Bruce, Australian Internationalist, which has recently been published. And Dr. Anne Moyle is a social historian of science and a biographer and author of the book Breakfast with Beaverbrook, which is sort of Britain in the 40s and the 50s, memoirs of an independent woman. Now, as I said, Dr. Moore can't be here tonight, so we're going to start off with David Lee on the topic of remembering Stanley Melvin Bruce, and then I'll speak, reading Dr. Moore's paper, and then we'll have questions. David Lee, you're very welcome. Thank you.
I thank the Sydney Institute for arranging and Dr. Anne Moyle for participating in this function, Remembering Stanley Melvin Bruce. In 1962, Australia's longest-serving Prime Minister, Robert Menzies, paid a gracious tribute to Bruce, Australia's Prime Minister from 1923 to 1929 and High Commissioner from 1933 to 1945. Menzies referred to Bruce as probably the outstanding Australian of our time. Menzies made this remark as he himself was approaching his record term as Prime Minister from 1949 to 1966. The Sun Herald newspaper commented that Menzies' remark would be neither popular nor historically endorsed. Bruce's six-year period as Prime Minister, the paper observed, was averagely successful but wrecked by a gross political miscalculation in 1929. And the fact remains that the greater part of his career was spent abroad. This parochial commentator voiced the sentiments of many Australians then and later. For many, Bruce was and remained simply a caricature, the man who wore spats, who lost his seat, and was more English than Australian. In this address, I will elaborate on why Menzies made his 1962 assessment of Bruce so at odds with the popular view of many then and today. And I draw on my published book, Stanley Melvin Bruce, Australian Internationalist. Bruce was no Englishman. He was born in 1883, the son of a Scots Northern Irish immigrant, John Munro Bruce. John Munro Bruce had emigrated to Victoria almost penniless in the mid-19th century. A self-made man, he became a partner in the Melbourne soft goods firm Patterson, Lang and Bruce. Stanley had three elder brothers and one elder sister. And his father was doing well enough by the 1890s to send his youngest son to the prestigious Melbourne Grammar School. Stanley's scholastic abilities were inferior to his athletic ones. But while he could not be described as an intellectual, he was an intelligent man capable of synthesising vast amounts of information and conveying his arguments in cogent prose. Stanley had a troubled adolescence. The 1890s depression hit the family hard, and John Munro Bruce was forced to launch a risky takeover of the company. In the midst of this corporate restructure in 1899, Stanley's second eldest brother, William Crawford Bruce, threw himself under a train at Rockdale Railway Station. And 2 years later, John Munro Bruce, afflicted by untreated diabetes, took his own life in a Paris hotel. After their father's death, the oldest brother, Ernest, combined with the youngest brother Stanley to put Patterson, Bruce and Lang on a sound footing. But first Stanley travelled to England in 1902 to put himself through Cambridge University, taking his mother and sister with him. Before he had even taken his degree, Ernest engineered for Stanley to take over as acting chairman, then chairman of this major Anglo-Australian company. While Ernest ran the company in Australia, Stanley helped direct the enterprise as a whole from London while simultaneously practicing as a commercial barrister. Stanley returned to Australia somewhat by accident during the First World War. By family agreement, Ernest Bruce, who had served in the Boer War, was supposed to stay in Australia as manager of Patterson, Lang and Bruce, while Stanley would enlist. Stanley joined the 2nd Battalion Royal Fusiliers, served with distinction in the British Army at Gallipoli, and was invalided out of the Army after being wounded in the knee in 1916. His war service left in Bruce a detestation of industrial warfare, and it conditioned his later approach to appeasement in the 1930s. Although he was then in middle age, older brother Ernest also enlisted and served through the war on the Western Front in the Royal Artillery. Ernest added to the Bruce family tragedies by himself taking his own life just before being demobilised in 1919. His mother and sister also having died earlier, the death of his much-loved brother affected Stanley most of all. Stanley had had to return to Australia to take his brother's place in the running of the family firm in 1917. While he was in Australia, Bruce's family connections, he'd married Ethel Anderson, one of the Manifold family, persuaded him to stand for the Nationalist in the seat of Flinders. A byproduct of this campaign was that to ward off a campaign for this semi-rural seat from the newly formed Country Party, the government led by Billy Hughes undertook to introduce preferential voting in Australian federal elections. It was in order to strengthen the Nationalist government from attack by the Country Party that Hughes invited Bruce in 1921 to become his treasurer. The key figures in Hughes's government in 1922 were Hughes himself and Walter Massey Green, the Minister for Trade and architect of the protectionist Green Tariff, and Bruce as well. To general surprise, Massey Green was defeated at the 1922 election by the Country Party candidate Roland Green, campaigning on the slogan, "Vote for Green without an E." The election gave the Country Party the balance of power in the House of Representatives and gravely weakened Hughes' prime ministership. That left the still relatively young Bruce as Hughes' only viable successor, despite only having about 1 year's experience in government. As a clean skin, Bruce was well equipped to conduct negotiations with Country Party leader Earl Page. These negotiations led to the formation of the composite Nationalist Country Party government, and Bruce became Prime Minister at not quite 40 years of age in 1923. Bruce's Prime Ministership has been described as unremarkable. Such a view, however, underestimates his period as Prime Minister from 1923 to 1929. I'll mention three of the coalition government's major achievements. The first was to construct with Page the Nationalist Country Party Coalition, which is today the Liberal National Party Coalition. From Bruce's time for the rest of the 20th century, the coalition would be in power for twice the length of time as Labor. After forming the government in 1923, Bruce and Page forced their respective party organisations to respect an electoral pact to give each other's sitting members immunity and generally to exchange electoral preferences. His second major achievement can broadly be described as nation building. Bruce oversaw the movement of Australia's federal capital from Melbourne to Canberra and the opening of the Parliament House in Canberra by the Duke of York. Other aspects of this nation building were federal aid to road building, the formation of the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, and supervision for significant immigration intake. And the third was the Financial Agreement of 1927, the most decisive reform of the Australian Constitution to that time. It established a loan council to to coordinate the borrowings of Commonwealth and state governments. In an effort to reform the system of Commonwealth arbitration, Bruce lost office and his own seat in 1929, but the end of his prime ministership was by no means the completion of his public service. When Joseph Lyons appointed him as resident minister and then High Commissioner in London, Bruce embarked on a second career, perhaps even more significant than his prime ministership, as a diplomat. As well as negotiating the Ottawa Agreement, a system of reciprocal preferences between Britain and Empire countries, Bruce oversaw the conversion of Commonwealth and state debts incurred before the Depression at high interest rates into loans with the lower interest rates that prevailed during the 1930s. Bruce also earned a considerable international reputation in the 1930s for his work at the League of Nations. Broadly, Bruce thought that the League, because of its military weakness, would fail if it tried to act as a security organisation. But he considered that it had great potential in the technical and economic fields and advocated international economic cooperation to raise world standards of living and nutrition. For this, he was nominated by his government for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1936. A few years later, in 1939, a League of Nations committee chaired by Bruce recommended establishing a Central Committee for Economic and Social Questions to direct the work of all relevant League committees. Although the committee's Bruce report was overtaken by the outbreak of war, it was a landmark in the history of international organisation that subsequently paved the way for the Economic and Social Council of the UN, which would coordinate the work of the UN's manifold specialised agencies. While the League was soon to break up, the Bruce Report helped lay, the foundation of the Economic and Social Council of the UN and also the UN Food and Agriculture Organisation, in whose establishment Bruce was centrally involved. Another high point in his diplomatic career was in 1936, when he chaired an international conference at the Swiss town of Montreux, which restored to Turkey its full national control over the Dardanelles by peaceful negotiation between treaty partners. Bruce's period as High Commissioner in London in the lead-up to and during the Second World War was a frustrating one. As a rationalist and peaceable man, Bruce naively thought that the warring nations, rather than fighting the horrors of industrial and total war, could be induced to the negotiating table where a peaceable world order might be negotiated. Bruce, like most members of the Lyons government, supported the appeasement of Germany, while also urging that the empire use the breathing space of peace to rearm. His support for appeasement stemmed both from his military experience at Gallipoli and his internationalist ideas. Moreover, Bruce's tireless advocacy for the proper reflection of the Australian point of view in the making of imperial policy put him at odds with the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who succeeded Chamberlain in 1940. Bruce and Churchill disagreed on many issues: the botched British attack on Narvik in April 1940, the possibility of a negotiated peace with Germany, also in 1940, and the fiasco of the largely Anzac operations in Greece and Crete. On fundamental issues like the idea of a negotiated peace in May-June 1940, Churchill was right and Bruce wrong, but on many strategic issues, Bruce's advice was sound. The real long-term significance of his diplomatic work in the 1940s was not strategic, but in the area of international post-war reconstruction. Bruce tirelessly lobbied British, Australian and US policy makers for international cooperation, as well as being placed on the shortlist for the UN's first Secretary General in 1945, he played a major role in the establishment of the FAO. After retirement in 1945, he was made a Viscount and became also first Chancellor of the Australian National University. The legacies of Bruce's public life are considerable. As the contemporary journalist Warren Denning noted of his prime ministership, he was worthy of consideration alongside Deakin, in some ways the Cambridge Blue was a better Prime Minister because more enduring things took solid shape under his practical businesslike hand. And as a diplomat, he made a significant contribution to the development of international organisation. When one considers the totality of his extraordinary public career, one can see the merits of Menzies' 1962 assessment of Stanley Melvin Bruce. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. And David's book, Stanley Melvin Bruce, Australian Internationalist, is, I think, is published by Continuum, but these days I think published in Britain and probably best bought on Amazon or some other equivalent. As explained, unfortunately Anne Moyle can't be here tonight. She's sick in Canberra, but she's given a paper and I'm going to read it out. So here we go. It's important to have this deeply researched biography for this rather melancholy man, Viscount Bruce, who has been largely forgotten in Australian historiography. Yet he is a unique figure in Australia's 20th century political history, who both yielded power in the 1920s as an elected, if unanticipated, Prime Minister. I'm sorry, that should be who wielded power in the 1920s as an elected, if unanticipated, Prime Minister, and in the next decade exercised significant power as a highly influential but unelected figure in shaping of Australian foreign policy. It is this theme of S.M. Bruce's role as foreign policy advisor and advocate to the Australian government during the 30s that I wish to take up, arising from my reading of David Lee's biography. As David Lee records, it was during his period as resident minister in London and Australian High Commissioner from 1933 that Bruce, as an engaged delegate and participant in the affairs of the League of Nations, formed the conclusion that the League was unfit to act as a collective security organisation and came to believe that fundamental changes to the international economic system could remove the root causes of international conflict and starve off war. Whilst Bruce had himself visited Germany in the 1930s, Lee observes that he lacked a sound understanding of the nature of the fascist regimes which had emerged in Europe and was too sanguine as a rational businessman about Nazi Germany's amenability to reason. Bruce's emphasis on reform of the international economic system and his close association with such conservative British politicians as Stanley Baldwin, Samuel Hoare and Neville Chamberlain led him increasingly through the 30s to the support of political conciliation in Europe and to endorsement of the appeasement policies pursued by successive British national governments. His position in respect of Australia was here a singular one. He had early championed the notion that the Australian High Commissioner should act as the unofficial channel between the Australian and UK governments on all matters concerning imperial policy, and that the Empire should act as one in its foreign policy. Thus, at a time when Australia had no diplomatic missions of its own in the world, and would have none until the end of 1939, S.M. Bruce stood as the key Australian figure beside the Prime Minister in the shaping of the Australian government's responses to the growing crisis in Europe. The political mood in Australia was particularly receptive to its High Commissioner's ideas. Prime Minister Joseph Lyons, a confirmed pacifist and devout Catholic who saw the rise of Nazism and fascism in Europe as a lesser threat than the growing emergence of communism, had early veered towards extending his domestic code of consultation, concession and compromise to the international sphere. Thus, on two trips to London in 1935 and 1937, Lyons stopped in Italy to meet Mussolini and express his enthusiasm for the dictator, whom he said publicly was, quote, a man who has done immense good, unquote, and to confirm Australia's friendly feelings towards him. I'm continuing Anne Moyle's paper. Earl Page, Lyons' coalition partner and deputy prime minister, who himself had pressed for increasing rearmament in government in the 1920s, now, as minister for commerce on two trade missions to Britain in 1936 and 1938, took little interest in the gathering political situation in Europe, but developed what he describes in his autobiography as an unqualified regard for Neville Chamberlain. Similarly, the Attorney General, Robert Menzies, also on the trade mission to London in 1935, had endorsed Baldwin's sustained policy of friendly dealings with Germany, and visiting that country himself in 1938, assured the Australian public in newspapers articles on his return that German intentions were essentially defensive. Only the old fire-eater, W.M., Billy Hughes, writing in his small book The Price of Peace, Australia and the War Today in 1935, emerged as a critic of the theory of appeasement, which he characterised in Parliament as like, quote, giving a snack of sandwiches to a hungry tiger. The Lyons government was accordingly at one with the British government in recognising Germany's annexation of Austria in the Anschluss of 1938, and in support of Neville Chamberlain's ultimate capitulation to Hitler over Czechoslovakia and the position of the Sudeten Germans. In this, Bruce's views and influence proved pivotal. As David Lee tells us, quote, he was unsympathetic to multi-ethnic Czechoslovakia, and in its 1924 treaty with France, which committed France to go to war if Germany invaded Czechoslovakia. In October 1938, Bruce advised Lyons, quote, if Czechoslovakia was not to remain a festering sore threatening the peace, the issue of the transference of the Sudeten area to Germany, either by plebiscite or some other means, would have to be faced, unquote. He himself became directly involved in defining the conditions for the timing of the transfer and clung firmly to the view that going to war over the Sudeten German question was unthinkable and should be avoided by necessary compromises with Germany at the 11th hour. As a result, Lyons and his government added their support for Britain in its direct representation to Czechoslovakia that its government should, quote, not delay in making a public announcement of the most liberal concessions which they could offer to Germany, unquote. Lyons, subsequently, in an act of diplomacy at a distance, cabled Neville Chamberlain suggesting that Bruce could fly to Rome as the British Prime Minister's emissary to enlist Mussolini's good offices in the matter. Central to the Australian situation was the lack of independent and informed internal input and analysis on the swiftly moving international situation. Lyons attempted, prodded by his then Minister for External Affairs, Senator George Pearce, in the mid-1930s, to set up a Department of External Affairs as an analytical and advisory arm, proved ineffective. Placed in the hands of a gruff military man, Colonel W. R. Hodgson, with scant resources and no concept of training graduates to fill diplomatic posts, this small unit was readily sidelined and did not act as a functional arm, departmental arm of the Australian Foreign Policy Service until 1941. Information on the rapidly changing European situation continued to flow to the Australian government through the Australian High Commissioner and the Dominion's office. Importantly, there was little impartiality or balance in the views Bruce presented. A sustained critic of Winston Churchill, he appears to have had no dealings with the political figures Harold Macmillan, Harold Nicholson, Robert Boothby, who independently of Churchill, made up the younger British band of articulate anti-appeasers. And I'm continuing Anne Moore's paper. A revealing perspective on the Australian government's position and their handling of major foreign policy issues emerges from a diary entry written by Richard Casey, treasurer in the Lyons government and a man who had wide international experience as Australia's liaison officer in Britain in the 1920s. As Casey recorded reflectively in 1940, he and his fellow ministers had, quote, given only an odd and uninformed half hour every 3 months to some ad hoc aspect of foreign affairs, so much so we were indifferent to the great forces that were in gestation that I don't remember a single discussion in cabinet of any event or tendencies in the Manchuria to Munich period, except what I now look back on as a most unreal discussion on Munich, the implications of which were entirely hidden from us, unquote. Casey added that, quote, Australia had its head in the domestic sands in those years with a vengeance, unquote. With John Curtin's leadership from 1935, the Labour Party also considered that their business was, quote, to keep Australia aloof from the wars of the world, unquote. As events sharpened in 1939, Bruce's commitment to appeasement remained unshaken. Visiting Australia with his wife in January 1939, David Lee records that Bruce toured the nation defending Chamberlain's appeasement policy to state cabinets, federal members, and the National Defence Council. The biography is silent on Bruce's reaction to Germany's invasion of Czechoslovakia in March 1939, but notes Bruce's concern and Chamberlain's firm stance on Britain's guarantee to Poland. Indeed, as late as August 1939, Bruce was warning Menzies, as Prime Minister, that, quote, with the limited effects which Britain and France could afford for Poland, I have been urging on the United Kingdom government the possibility of exploring every avenue to keep the door of negotiation open. Close quotes. Bruce's long commitment to compromise and peace at any price would lead him to decline Menzies' offer in November 1939 of the new post of Australia's representative in Washington because, as David Lee suggests, he hoped idealistically and naively for a negotiated end to war. It was a position that in the dark years of war, as Britain and the Empire struggled alone to defeat Germany, Bruce continued to uphold, believing, along with some others, until 1943, that a negotiated peace, if not with Hitler, then with a successive German government, seemed a credible alternative. With such evidence before us, the attempt made following Lyons' sudden death in office in April 1939, notably by Page and by Casey, to induce Bruce to return to Australia with a view to his possible leadership of a national government formed by all parties, a position Bruce was willing to contemplate, takes on a new dimension and invites some serious historical reflection. Fortunately, Menzies' election and subsequent dismissal delivered Australia into the purposeful wartime leadership of John Curtin. And I'm now concluding Ann Moore's paper. Reflecting on S.M. Bruce's move across the critical 1930s, my evaluation of this complex man rests essentially on the fact that from his entrenched positions, his contacts, and his reappointment as Australian High Commissioner for a second term in 1938, he remained the major, prevailing, and authoritative voice for the Australian government in respect of its foreign policy in Europe. The 1930s, in general, was in no way a period of distinguished statesmanship. In light of this, I cannot subscribe to David Lee's concluding endorsement of the tribute paid by Menzies to Viscount Bruce in 1962 at his installation as Chancellor of the new Australian National University that, quote, as a statesman, he was the outstanding Australian of our time, unquote. In brief, however, it can be said that the period of the Bruce Page government did exhibit statesmanlike qualities. Then these two very different men, Bruce the financially gifted and Page the founder of the Federal Country Party and Deputy Prime Minister and Treasurer, managed to establish successful Conservative coalition government as a part of the political culture of Australia, which continued to dominate Australian politics for most of the 20th century. Moreover, working from a shared national perspective, they transformed and systematised Commonwealth and state relations and gave the Commonwealth government a strong new central authority. In many fields, theirs was a remarkably constructive collaboration. I have then, again concluding Ann Moore's paper, to take issue with David Lee's observation that Page's autobiography, True and Surgeon, was a case of, quote, the tail wagging the dog in the Bruce Page government, unquote. Although he himself concludes that, quote, Bruce never underestimated Page and the strong personal and professional relationship which the two men created was fundamental to the success of the coalition, unquote, Page is singularly absent from David Lee's story, and he subscribes all the constructive undertaking of that government to S.M. Bruce. It was, however, essentially a highly cooperative administration. writing to his old friend and colleague, as Page prepared to take up his autobiographical pen in 1956, Bruce had this to say. Quote, Bruce DuPage, you are better equipped than anyone else to do this job. The interesting fact that will emerge is that our government was the only one that faced Australia's problems and her future progress realistically and constructively. We laid some very sound foundations which have been built upon in the years since, and many of our ideas, which were received with the utmost hostility when we pronounced them, have after a lapse of 20 to 30 years become platitudes even in the mouths of those who derided them. That concludes Anne Moore's paper. As I said, David Lee's book can be probably best obtained online. And now we come to questions and discussion, which should be directed to David. Thank you. I should also say before we start this that, of course, both papers will be published in the Sydney Papers online. So questions and discussion. There's a question here. Yeah, okay. David, you just come back here. Yeah.
Now you mentioned that a couple of scientists serve as a Gallipoli and sustaining a knee wound. Was he also awarded the Military Cross and the French Croix de Guerre in the First World War?
Yes,
just repeating some of this for Sky. It's about Bruce's service at Gallipoli, and
Yes, he was indeed. He was awarded both the Military Cross and the Croix de Guerre for his military feats at Gallipoli, fighting not for the AIF but for the British Army.
Why did he join the British Army and not the AIF?
Well, Bruce was a resident at that time of London, and although he travelled periodically back and forth to Australia to attend to family business, from 1902, Stanley Melbourne Bruce was a resident in England, practising both as a commercial barrister and attending and serving as the chairman of Patterson, Lang and Bruce. It was also a case that for a person of his class, it would have been, I think, easier for him to gain a commission in the British Army than perhaps the AIF. So those two reasons, I think, his residency in England, and I think that's the primary reason why he enlisted in the British
Army. Why was it easier to gain a commission in Britain than in Australia?
Well, he joined the Inns of Court Regiment. He was a lawyer, and I think it was just I think easier for him because of his residency in England and his ability through his legal connections and business connections to seamlessly get into the British Army and be commissioned quickly than it was to perhaps join the AIF.
Okay, so there's a question down the back there.
Yeah, I'm interested in the war years when Menzies and I spent so much time over in London. How did the two of them get on? And does Bruce talk much about Menzies sitting in on the cabinet in the issues about challenging, interfering, etc.?
Could you just repeat the question, Dan?
Yeah, the question was concerning the relationship between Robert Menzies, the Prime Minister from 1939 to 1941, and Stanley Bruce, the High Commissioner in London during that time. And as you rightly commented, Menzies did come to London for a period, while Bruce was High Commissioner. I think broadly, Bruce did everything he could to make Menzies' visit as smooth as possible, but did urge him also to try to form a national government with Curtin when he got back, because of the precarious nature of Menzies' majority. Menzies' mission, I suppose, was unsuccessful in Menzies tried to get the focus of the British War Cabinet on the situation in the Far East, where Australia was imperiled by possible Japanese aggression. Menzies didn't really succeed in his aims in trying to get more of a British focus on that theatre when they were so in peril from Germany. But when Menzies returned to Australia, Menzies cabled back to Bruce asking whether Menzies should go over again and try and sit in the war cabinet for a longer period. And I suppose Bruce was a bit cautious about that. He worried about Menzies' parliamentary majority and said it was a matter for his judgment, but said that he thought it would be unlikely again to be successful given Churchill's dominance of the war cabinet. But ironically, one outcome of all that event, all those events, were that Australia succeeded in persuading Churchill to get an Australian representative on the British War Cabinet. That was first Earl Page and second Bruce himself. Did Menzies and Bruce get on? I think they had their differences in their political career, which goes back to the 1920s, when Menzies opposed a referendum that Bruce was putting forward for a greater federal control of industrial relations. That was back in 1926. But I think in the interest of the prosecution of the war, in that period of 1941, Menzies and Bruce did get on well in a political sense.
There's a question here.
Yes, I just wonder why, when the Labor Party constantly honours its previous prime ministers, calls universities after them and honours them, and also doesn't forget them, they're still heroes, light on the hill and everything. And the Liberals are constantly buried on, bang, on with the next.
She said Labor honours all its former prime ministers, but the conservative side of politics doesn't.
Well, there are a couple of points to be made there. Firstly, Menzies lost not only an election, but his own seat in 1929.
Bruce did.
By taking a gamble on the issue of industrial relations, saying a big change had to be made. And then, apart from a year or so back in Australia as a minister, a junior minister in Lyon's government, he was an expatriate. So I think when he moved away from the focus of many Australians, they lost sight of him. Even though his achievements on the world stage, you know, being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, being nominated for UN Secretary General, were significant. So I think in Bruce's case, there were some issues there.
It actually is a culture of the Liberal Party.
The question is this a culture of the Liberal Party or not?
I think it's certainly true that I think Labor reveres its leaders in a way that perhaps the Liberal Party hasn't.
Okay, Stuart?
Did you find in your study that Bruce was a consistent in relation to his ideas? You've touched on his domestic policies, and especially in industrial relations. In 1926, he took a referendum to the Australian people for greater powers in relation to industrial relations. And in 1929, he went to an election to do away with the federal industrial relations system and to cede it back to the states. Did you find that he was a consistent person with his views?
He had a problem with ambiguity. He had a problem with the overlapping of Commonwealth and state jurisdiction on industrial relations. And he tried to solve that, as you said, in the first instance, by greater federal control. And then, having been rebuffed in that regard then and trying again later, he decided, well, then we'll give it to the states. So whereas someone like Robert Menzies perhaps wouldn't have been troubled so much by that ambiguity, Bruce did have a problem with it and thought it was a serious problem that had to be rectified in one way or the other.
And was he consistent? If he had trouble domestically, was he consistent on an international level?
Yeah, well, we can go back to one of the reasons that propelled Bruce into national politics was that he happened to be in overseas in 1921 when the government wanted a representative to represent Australia at the League of Nations. They couldn't find anyone, but remembered that he was over there. and persuaded him to represent Australia. He did the job so well and got a lot of international press and national press for the way he represented Australia at the league then, that that was one of the reasons why Hughes, on Bruce's return, asked Bruce to enter the government. So he always had that international focus, always was a League of Nations person. I think there was a gradual shift in his political views that were... A very crucial moment was in the Depression, 1932-33, where Bruce was frustrated by the response of national governments to adopt protectionist and restrictive measures in the economy. Bruce said, as a sort of proto-Keynesian, that the way out of that was for international coordination to stimulate consumption. So he was consistent always in being an internationalist, but there was a progressive change in his ideas in the 1930s and 1940s. And he was, as I've mentioned in the book, a very staunch proponent of international cooperation. That's where I see his contribution on the international stage to be. Despite all the things that Anne Moyle said about appeasement, it's all correct. He was a very staunch appeaser, but I think he was also a man ahead of his time, and he was looking forward, and one can see in many of the ideas he was putting forward in the 1930s and 1940s, things that were implemented and carried out at a later stage.
It's interesting you use the word ambiguity. Bruce, to me, seems to be caught between not knowing where he belongs, and also in the way of many great so-called statesmen, to live off the back of other people's cleverness.
Yep.
I mean, his agricultural ideas were straight out of F.L. McDougall. They had nothing to do with anything he did himself.
Yep.
He put them forward many times and got a Nobel Peace Prize because the Australian government offered it. McDougall got forgotten. And he seems to have come to the League of Nations as something that someone else popped him in there, and he did very well. He was a great negotiator, he was a great networker, but he also had this arrogance that overestimated himself and underestimated others, which is a classic case with Lyons, who was much more crafty than he was and was able to get around him. But to what extent is he caught with this problem at the time of really not knowing whether he was British or Australian? And there are letters in the file where he's sitting in London writing back to Lyons at one point, this long, long letter in his handwriting, which is so hard to read. It's in the files in Canberra. And he's almost downloading about his own, you know, problems with his firm and what he's going to do for his wife and whether he should come back to Australia, because this was about the time when he couldn't make his decision about whether he'd stay on as High Commissioner or become High Commissioner. And do you notice in any of your reading that he has got this conflict, which is a very Australian conflict of the time, of not knowing where he really belonged? And can you tell us a bit more about it?
Sure. They're very good points and interesting points. If you look at the trajectory of his life, you know, he was born in Australia. He was born of a Scots Northern Irish father. So the criticism that he was English, I think, has to take that into account. And he always objected to the idea of Englishness. He lived in England from 1902 to 1914. And then he spent a lot of his later life as an expatriate as well. So there was always that ambiguity in terms of his where he lived, for example. But he always regarded himself as Australian. And in his dealings with British diplomats, I think he remarked to a fellow diplomat to be wary of, you know, what British diplomats were saying to them. And he was a very hard-nosed negotiator, for example, during the Ottawa negotiations and during the negotiations on the conversion of Australian loans, where he actually even sort of was threatening to Neville Chamberlain, the then Chancellor of the Exchequer, a possible Australian default. In relation to his dealings with other people, he did rely on other people, Page as Treasurer, McDougall and others, in terms of his ideas that he put forward at the League of Nations and elsewhere. But I think you also have to give him credit for championing those ideas and for you know, going when no one else was prepared to speak in 1935 on nutrition, he was the one who got it up there and spoke about it. In his personal dealings with people, his stubbornness on certain occasions, for example, I mentioned his unwillingness to try and forge an alliance with Billy Hughes in the 1920s, was one of the causes for his downfall in 1929. But on the other hand, he was very ecumenical in his political friendships. For example, Harold Wilson, the later British Prime Minister, and Bruce formed a very constructive relationship. And Bruce and the former Labour man, Senator Pearce, formed very constructive relationships. So he is a very complex man, whose the nature of whose political career accentuated that ambiguity.
Stuart, how would you characterise the relationship between Bruce and Richard Casey?
Well, Casey was 7 or 8 years younger than Bruce, had also gone to Melbourne Grammar School, was educated in Cambridge University like Bruce. They were very close, and it was, in a way, like a father-son relationship, because Bruce had no children of his own. And Casey was very much a protege. So in the mid-1920s, Bruce appointed Casey as his liaison officer with the British government in London. And the letters between Casey and Bruce have been published by the Department of Foreign Affairs, and a very revealing indication of the nature of that relationship. In the 1930s, Casey himself entered politics and was to become treasurer in the UAP government of Lyons, when Bruce was High Commissioner, and they retained their friendship and were very close politically and personally.
My father was a member of the Labour Party who, like thousands of others in Victoria, got expelled and became a member of the Democratic Labour Party, but he was never a political conservative. And as a young boy, he didn't say much about Bruce except to say that he wore spats, which was all he had to say, really. Why did he wear spats? I mean, it wasn't the sort of Australian thing to do, and it excited my father and gave him lines to run with for the rest of his life. What was the spat stuff all about?
There was a story that Bruce had an injury with his leg deriving from the war, that he went to a football match in Victoria one day and wore them to basically help with his injury. And when the press noted that he's wearing spats, they criticised him for it or made fun of it, and he played up to it by continuing to wear them afterwards. He did have a sense of humour. And another story, just after becoming Prime Minister, the press got wind of the fact that he drove a Rolls-Royce and wanted to take a picture of him arriving at the Parliament in Melbourne in his car. Getting wind of that, Bruce decided he would drive instead the most dilapidated car he could find. So he did have a sense of humour, and I think that's part of that story.
There's a question here. Yeah.
I have read, I don't know whether it's historical or not, but there was quite a group of people in England during the war who were pushing Menzies to quite a significant role, or taking over from Churchill and then sent back. But I have read that there was a group who was backing, saw some hope in Menzies they couldn't see in Churchill.
This is the suggestion made by the historian David Day and others that Menzies wanted to become a significant British figure, perhaps British Prime Minister, and that there were people in Britain, in the British Conservative Party, who actually supported this. That's the David Day thesis. I think it's fair to call it a thesis, yeah.
Yeah. When Menzies went to London, he, like Bruce, became critical of Churchill. At that stage, the war wasn't going well for Britain, which was alone. The British Empire was alone and in dire straits. And there were many British ministers and public servants who were also critical of Churchill. David Day, as Gerard has mentioned, has made a thesis that Menzies was aiming at engineering an intervention in British politics which might see him supplant Churchill. I'm doubtful about that, but certainly Bruce did egg Menzies on, it's fair to say, in criticising Churchill on various occasions, and both were very critical of aspects of Churchill's war leadership.
It would seem a crazy aspiration, though, wouldn't it? How would you get into a British parliament, then get into
But wouldn't that be more because Churchill was very anti-Australians? I mean, Churchill had no interest in Australians. He was known to say some extremely rude things about Australians. And that seems to me more in keeping with the feeling in Menzies, too, that he wasn't nearly as enamoured by British upper-class people as people think. You know, he might have liked the tradition of Britain, but Menzies was very critical also of that upper-class, snooty, eucolonial kind of attitude. Wouldn't that have been more the reason why why Menzies and Bruce might have been critical of Churchill?
Oh, I think certainly. I think resentment of the Dominions being marginalised from major decisions and perhaps being treated as second class in a way. But on the other hand, it is true that the Australian war effort in 1940-41 in the Mediterranean theatre was very significant, and Churchill recognised that, and that was part of the reason why Menzies was so feted by the British government and by the British press when he came over here.
Just a final comment about the latter years. You would have seen about a year ago the National Archives in Canberra did a presentation of Bruce, very effectively, I thought. But tell us about his final years, because we know his period as Prime Minister, we know his period as Australian High Commissioner. And then the 50s come along and beyond. I mean, what are his declining years like, and where did he still died? He was in Britain when he died, wasn't he?
Just
tell us about his final years, and what was his funeral like, and where's he buried? And
he left the High Commissionership in 1945, and I think he would have wanted or would have liked the Australian government, which was Labor at the time, to help him get an important job, I think somewhere particularly in the international field. He didn't get so much help from the Australian government, but the British government did, because they elevated him to the House of Lords, and he took that position because it helped him to make political statements about things that he was keen on, particularly the Food and Agriculture Organisation. The British government also appointed him to a financial body that helped industries to raise capital. So he was very active both as a peer in the House of Lords, chairing bodies for the Food and Agricultural Organisation. In sport, he was also active. He became the first Australian to captain the Royal and Ancient Golf Club, and he was the president of the Leander Rowing Club. So in athletic and sporting fields, he earned some distinctions. I think in Australia, the most important job that he undertook was to become the first Chancellor of the Australian National University. He was very keen to take that on because he loved Canberra, having been the Prime Minister that oversaw the transfer from Melbourne to Canberra. And he took a very active role as Chancellor of the ANU in trying to get funding for the ANU, this newly established university, which was to become Australia's perhaps finest university. When he died, his will stipulated that he wanted his ashes to be scattered over Canberra, the city he loved so much. And when I was a student at Bruce Hall, one of the colleges named after him at ANU, I did hear the perhaps apocryphal story that when the terms of the will were executed, the working class patrons of the Ainslie Hotel in Canberra made sure to cover their beer glasses in the outdoor beer garden.
My father would have done that. Yes, he would have done.
He would drink the spats.
Take a seat, David. Look, many thanks to Dr. Lee. Look, I think it's been a fascinating night tonight. Unfortunately, Anne Moore couldn't be here, but her paper is a very important paper. And David Lee has given us his own paper based on his book and then taken about 30 minutes of question discussion. And I certainly learned a lot tonight, and I'm sure we all did. So thanks to people in our audience once again, fired in some terrific questions and points of comment. Thanks to David Lee for coming up or down from Canberra to talk to us tonight. Best of luck with the success of your book. I hope it gets an Australian publisher. I think it deserves an Australian publisher because Stanley Melbourne Bruce, he won two elections. He was a very influential player in Australian politics and diplomacy, and one of the most influential Australians of the 20th century. So it's proper that he be remembered. And we played our part at the Sydney Institute tonight with the help of David Lee and Anne Moore in remembering Stanley Melbourne Bruce. So many thanks. Well done, David.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.